Next, this is column two, we asked ourselves why we were angry. Why were they on our list? What are the reasons? And the big book on page 65 gives you examples of that. You've got Mr. Brown in the first column, and you've got the cause. And you see, and someone pointed out, I heard a big book study once point out that the most number of words in any of the sentences in column two is 19. And he said, I give my sponsees one extra word. They can't write more than 20 words in a point. And it's all point form. And the beauty of this is only you are going to see this, and therefore it's only what it means to you. You can write shorthand to yourself. I, for instance, think back to a particular 24-hour period with an ex-girlfriend that I used to think about a lot, and if someday I could write a book about it, if anyone would read it, I don't think it's that interesting, but I could write a lot about my feelings and her feelings and what happened and what didn't happen and all that. All I put down that day. That's all I put down. I knew what I was talking about. So let's say I put Hitler down. I have put Hitler down. I don't know exactly what I wrote down beside him at the time, but these days I might say, spawn anti-Semitism, responsible for the deaths of millions of people, not just Jews, but millions of people, and it could happen again. So those would be the causes I would put down. Guy who cuts me off as I turn right, didn't see me, you know, it's too different, could cause accidents for others, could have killed me. Okay? Just 4 points. My wife, I'm going to use an imaginary wife here because I don't think it would be fair to my wife to say anything about her, but, you know, and this isn't my wife. It's not you, dear. Spends too much money, not enough sex, berates me, belittles me, and I could have a whole list of things, you know. Keeps pushing me to do things, makes me spend more time than I want to on things that I don't care about. You know, I mean, you can imagine these things, you know. For husbands, you could have, you know, is messy, doesn't put the toilet seat down. It could be as petty as that, and could be as serious as relies on me for all emotional support, isolates himself. I don't know what, too much sports, whatever. I mean, they can be some pretty deep things. For principles, you know, I'll never get thin. Well, why does this bother me? I want to be thin so I'll be attractive to others. I want to be thin so I'll be healthy. Two very different motives there, hey? But those are both causes. I want to be thin so I can be a star in OA. You know what I'm saying? So like different reasons there. Talk show hosts, make people idiots into idiots. speak to the lowest common denominator. Aren't really interested in my opinion and are really just interested in controversy. Okay, particular politician, I won't go into any details, but you know, did this, didn't do this, didn't say this, whatever. Ex-girlfriends used me, exploited me, dumped me. You can imagine what to put down. Just point form. Specific, but not a story. You don't write a story, you just write down the causes. How long can that take? You're again, off the top of your head, you're just writing down reasons that bother you. Just like that. It's not deep introspection, although you do learn something. As you write them down, you begin to realize that your motives are usually kind of mixed. My daughter, you know, like a long time ago, not doing well in school, worried about her future, I'm going to look stupid to the teacher, you know, she stands up to me, I kind of like it, I really don't like it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I like spunk and I don't like spunk, that kind of stuff. I mean, you begin to sort of, just as you write things down, it begins to be very interesting as you begin to understand really why these people are on your list. Because sometimes they're on your list for really terrible and bad reasons, and sometimes they're on your list for really stupid reasons. I remember being, my wonderful, loving sister-in-law was dying of cancer, and my wife was spending a lot of time with her, helping her out. And I remember resenting my sister-in-law and putting her on this list. And when I put down the cause, it was, she's sick. Oh, she's taking more time away from my wife than I want to give. oh. You know, and I began to realize my reasons were progressively worse, that they were much more self-interested than I thought I was in relation to her, because I loved her, absolutely loved her. And yet I was resenting her for absolutely, for mostly bad, very, well, completely bad reasons. My grandmother, in the last couple of years of her life, she suffered a stroke, and she lost her ability to do the one thing she loved in the world, which was reading. She was already had difficulty with her eyes. She had difficulties with walking. She couldn't hear very well. She was really isolated in many ways, but reading was her life. And she lost that, and she became a relatively bitter person in her later years. Still very loving to me, but it was hard for her. She was very, very sad. And I realized when I put her down on my list the first time that, I mean, I grew up with her and with her husband, my grandfather, and my parents. We lived in a house all together. And they were, I mean, I was so close to them. And I realized that the last couple years of my life with my grandmother had almost obliterated my memory of the first 24 years with her, which were glorious years. And as I worked through this, I mean, suddenly I remembered the whole past. And I realized my resentment against my grandmother was because she was sick. I mean, duh, right? She was sick. And just it all went away. Just writing it out, it went away. It was that wonderful just using this form. It doesn't always happen, but I'm just saying that sometimes you just realize, oh, that's why it bothers me, and it no longer bothers you. Sometimes just writing the name down, sometimes just writing the cause down does it. But we're not finished, but we're writing down the cause. So that's the cause. So again, we finished column one. You may make 50 copies of this form, and you may write down on 50 pages a list in column one in each of the boxes. And then you've got column two, and beside each name, you write down the causes in point form about why they're there. And then the big book goes on. It says, we asked ourselves why we're angry. That's column two. And then column three. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, how we feel about ourselves, our pocketbooks, money issues, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore. We were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries, right? And that's the causes. And then we asked ourselves, was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations which had been interfered with? And if you look at the form, you'll see that there's places for you to put X's underneath these subcolumns of self-esteem, security, ambitions, personal relations, sex relations, and is any fear involved? Just put a check mark. In England they call it ticks. We call them check marks. And you do that beside each of the causes. So, for instance, beside Hitler, spawned anti-Semitism. Did that affect my self-esteem? Yes. It certainly affected my self-esteem because as I grew up and suffered some anti-Semitism, not a great deal, but some of it, it affected how I felt about myself. Responsible for the deaths of millions of people? Did that affect my self-esteem? Actually, no. Didn't affect my self-esteem. So I wouldn't put a check mark beside that cause. The guy who cut me off didn't see me. That didn't affect my self-esteem. Didn't see me, that affects my self-esteem. Okay? So my recommendation, you could do it either way, but my recommendation is that you go down each of the sub-columns. You do all the self-esteem ones and all of the 10 or 20 or 30 pages of your forms and check to see by each of the causes, not by the name in column one, but by the cause in column two, whether that has affected your self-esteem. So your self-esteem is how you feel about yourself. Has it affected it in any way? The second sub-column is security or pocketbook. So security is your sense of safety related as well to money, security of money. But it's more than that. So spawned anti-Semitism affects my security? You're damn tootin' it does. Responsible for the deaths of millions? No. Could happen again? It sure does affect my sense of security. The guy who cut me off didn't see me affected my sense of security. Didn't see me affected my sense of security. Could kill others affects my sense of security. That night with my girlfriend affect my self-esteem? Yeah. Affect my security? No. Okay? So it just depends. on the issue, but you put a check mark besides the ones that seem to fit. The next column is ambitions, what you want out of life. The chances are very, very good that you will always check this one, because if it's on your resentment list, it's something that has happened that you didn't want to happen. And if ambition is what you want to have happened, clearly it has affected your ambitions. So generally speaking, the chances are good you would fill that out. Personal relations affected your personal relations. Spawned anti-Semitism affected my personal relations with people who were anti-Semitic to me. Not many, but there were some. Responsible for the deaths of millions didn't affect my personal relations. Could happen again. Affects my personal relations, because I did, at any rate, because I always worried that it could happen again and affected how I related to people. That night affected my personal relations. The guy who cut me off didn't affect my personal relations. Okay? Or, you know, the various causes I had didn't affect them. So it just depends. So you put check marks beside that. Sex relations, same thing. Check marks wherever it happens, wherever it does affect. And again, sex relations doesn't simply mean whether you had good sex or not. It means that it affects your relationship with the gender to which you're attracted. Does it affect it in some way, shape, or form, either individually or in general? Sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, let's not forget. I mean, there are people in this program who have been vilely abused by people by other people, either physically, emotionally, or sexually, or all three at the same time. And when they put those people down, and they put down the causes. I mean, the causes may be very lengthy. There may be many of those causes, and you can bet and rest self assured, because I've talked to a lot of people who suffered that those check marks are all the way through. Affects self-esteem, affects security, affects ambitions, affects personal relations, affects sex relations, and there's fear involved too. That they've got that all down there. And for some people and for some of the causes, I've had that all down there. With my parents in the early days of the program, a lot of those things would have been there, because my whole being was, and with my wife too, my whole being was intertwined with them. And so a lot of everything was checked off in there. The column is any fear there, because you'll notice that in the example given on page 65, fear is in there as well. So there's a separate column for fear. That's the first filling out of the first three columns of the resentment form. How much time can that take, and how much thought does it require? I would suggest very little time and very little thought. It's just writing down what's on your mind. It's not hard work. I mean, it can be very deep at times. I mean, if you're writing down some things that are truly, truly difficult to write down, of course it's not emotionally just a snap to write them down. But then you're not being asked to write down more than what's on your mind. Okay, page 65 right at the bottom, it says, we went back through our lives, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. So at the end of filling out the three columns, we're looking at it carefully. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse. So we're writing also down things that we may have done that bother us. Like I may have stolen, and I write down the store I stole from, and then I may write down, you know, took money from them or took goods from them, didn't pay them back. I feel guilty every time I walk into the store or something like that. I mean, that's the remorse. And then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. We're on page 66 now. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. I have a note here. Someone once said, you take poison and hope the other person dies. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? That's true for anyone. Anyone who spends time on hatred and worry just wastes time. But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentments is infinitely grave. We found that it's fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, we drink again, and with us to drink is to die. So if we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit, then we'll start to eat again. And the form with all of the check marks is graphically very powerful, because when you look at column 3 with all of those check marks, you realize that the things that you've put down on paper, that the people, the institutions and principles that you've put down on paper are absolutely controlling major parts of you. How you feel about yourself, your self-esteem, how safe you feel, your security, what you want out of life, your ambitions, your relationships with other people, and your sex relations, and that you're full of fear. All those check marks are just going to hit you in the eye and say, you're wasting your time. The past is killing you. You can't feel good about yourself. You can't feel safe. You can't feel satisfied because what you want isn't happening. And you have lousy relationships. So it's grave. It says if we were to live, we had to be free of anger. Now, I think it's very important to understand that. Free of anger, not that we had to be had to feel no anger, but we had to be free of it. You can't stop being angry. But I heard Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, you know, the person who wrote on Death and Dying, she came to Winnipeg years and years ago, and she said, the only real anger lasts 5 seconds. The rest is sickness. If it lasts longer than that, it's sick. That was very insightful, I thought. I mean, I once knew someone who would tell me stories about working in a place where there was a bully. And the bully, and I knew a lot of people who worked there, and the bully, they said, just intimidated all of the people I knew and really liked. And sometimes I'd be invited to parties at that workplace. And I couldn't talk to that person who was the bully because I was so angry. And I kept avoiding that person throughout that party. You know, if that person went somewhere, I'd move somewhere else. You know who talked to that person? The person who told me about all these horrible things. So that person was sane. And that person got over the anger. And it was no longer anger. You know, I was angry at my friend. I told my friend the wrath did end. I was angry at my foe. I told it not. The wrath did grow. You know, sane people talk about their anger and get rid of it. And it's over. People like me, insane people, who don't live in the sunlight of the spirit, who aren't sane, live with it, and it gets worse and worse and worse. And it ends up killing me. So if we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. The grouch is the immediate anger. The brainstorm is the long-term festering, gets worse and worse anger. We're not for us. I don't get that from the dictionary, but Bill translates it in a book called As Bill Sees It. He quotes it, but gives it a different words. I love these words. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. So normal people have the dubious luxury of being angry and continuing to be angry and hating. But if I continue to be angry, if I continue to hate, I die. So I can't do it. We turned back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We couldn't wish them away any more than alcohol. If you've ever had a situation where you had to leave the room because someone entered it, and I think most of us have had that at some time or another in our lives, then you know that that person controls you. And even if it doesn't happen literally, if it happens even figuratively, that when that person comes in the room or when you think about that person, you can't think straight. You're being controlled. And the check marks will prove to you how much you're being controlled. And they should give you this sense of urgency. If I don't get rid of it, I'm never going to live. I'm going to continue to eat over it. That's the purpose of those check marks. They're very graphic illustrations of how controlled you are by how you're reacting to life. So, the hardest are the people who have harmed you or others. Those are the hardest. You know, if you've harmed someone else, okay, you can say, well, I realize how that harms me, but maybe I can deal with it. If life goes on, But it's the cases where people have harmed other people, either you or other people, that really kill you because you can't stand. You're angry. You wish it hadn't happened. You wish those people didn't exist. You know, and all. How do you deal with it? Here's their advice. This was our course. We realized the people who wronged us, and I would say the people who wronged others as well, were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, that, by the way, is column 2 and column 3. Symptoms is column 2, the causes. The way these disturbed us is column 3, all those check marks, the self-esteem stuff. They, like ourselves, were sick too. Now, that's a tough proposition, but it's very important to understand. We ask God to, and I'll get into that. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. The manuscript, the draft, used to say that we would cheerfully grant a friend who has cancer. And I like that. A sick friend is fine too, but I like that because I use the example of a person who has a brain tumor. People who have brain tumor sometimes are affected by the pressure of the tumor to say things or do things that are aberrant or sometimes quite hateful. People with Tourette's syndrome will say things that they don't mean to say. People who are in extreme pain will say things that they don't mean. Children will say, "I hate you, Daddy," when they don't mean it. I knew a guy once who was really quite a grouch, and I found out that he has scar tissue all over his body from a burn that he suffered. He's always in pain. I'd be pretty grouchy if I were always in pain. When my wife, we were going to birthing classes, and they told us about the transition time when there was a 20-minute period where your wife might blame you for all the pain that you have caused her. She doesn't mean it. She really loves you. It's just pain and hormones working at the same time. And if my wife had said that to me, I would have understood it. She didn't, but if she had. So there are all kinds of times in our lives when we fully understand when people do things or say things that are hurtful. You know, person has a heart attack in the middle of driving and kills someone. What are we going to say about it? A person killed my friend or something? It was a horrible accident, but how can you blame a person who has a heart attack in the middle of something, right? So whatever it is, things happen, people do things, and we understand them. Can we not understand people who are in spiritual pain? Can we not understand, because we ourselves are in spiritual pain, we know we're distant from the God we want to be close to. Can we not understand that those who do pain often have no other options? They don't know what their choices are in life, that they have grown up in a spiritual vacuum. How many abusers were themselves abused? You know, I don't know what the figures are, but I'll make you bet it's over 80% to 90%. How many people who are terrible, awful parents grew up with parents who didn't give them much of a sense of what kind of choices there are in parenting? How many parents can't you say, if you had trouble with your parents, can't you say they tried their best given the limited resources they had at their disposal? How many people who, and when I looked at Hitler and when I looked at the commandants of the concentration camps, I mean, I saw people who did horrible things, horrible, horrible, horrible things, but who themselves, every time they did something horrible, became less and less of human beings. They weren't even animals. Animals wouldn't do what they did. They became complete non-human beings by what they did. They were, every act they committed made them less and less able to become human again. I did criminal law for a number of years, and I can tell you, I hardly ever met a person who committed an offense, whether it was murder or whether it was, you know, just theft, who didn't himself or herself have tremendous problems and themselves have issues, such that I could say, "There but for the grace of God go I." I knew that. Very rarely did I meet anyone who was pure evil, and even those people were purely sick, because pure evil people have no conscience, have no humanity. They simply do not know. They live a lie. They live in a completely different world from mine. Most people, though, suffer from delusions about the world. I mean, I'm a mediator and these days, and what I do is help people understand their misperceptions. And I can tell you, misperceptions arise so easily in our lives that we can assume that someone says something, we assume what that person means, when in fact that person has an entirely different reason. I just did a mediation where a supervisor and employee said to me individually, he hates me and has no respect for me, and I have a lot of respect for him. Same words. Both of them had the impression that the other one had no respect for the other, and in fact they each had tremendous respect for each other. And I know when it happened. I can even point to the time, and I did. I was able to point them to the time. The supervisor had been a supervisor for many years and was always a micromanager, had never really delegated authority to anyone. A new employee comes in to do a job, and the supervisor is so impressed by this employee that he says to the employee, you're in charge. Now, anyone who knew the supervisor would say, this is the greatest compliment that has ever been paid by this man to this other man. Right? I mean, what an incredible compliment. To delegate authority and you're a micromanager, you must think this person is incredible, right? The person who took on the job had no idea of that and just said, well, of course I'm in charge, right? I mean, that's what I was hired to do. So they start off from a complete disconnect. And then if the supervisor has some suggestions to the person who is working it, the supervisor starting from the position of, I really think you're terrific, here are some suggestions to make you even better, but the person who's receiving this is just hearing, you're doing a lousy job. Here's what you're doing wrong. Never hears the good stuff because the supervisor says, well, I've already complimented this person beyond anything I could possibly imagine. Complete disconnect. So I know how disagreements and misperceptions occur all through our lives. How someone says to us, how are you? And we say, what the hell do you mean by that? You know? And yeah, ever happened to you? Good morning, what do you mean by that? You know, and yet sometimes good morning is just good morning, right? So because of that, because we're capable of doing that, all kinds of people are living in a world of fear and paranoia where anyone even saying hello to them is actually out to get them. And they lash out. So even the person who's done the sickest things, when you look at it from that light, you can feel tremendous pity for them. At the least, you can feel pity. You're not asked in the big book to forgive. You're only asked to feel compassion and pity. You don't have to forgive a thing. Only tolerance, compassion, and pity. There but for God, the grace of God, go I. And the big book on page 552, many of you are aware of that passage, gives you, if you have trouble with that still, gives you another way of dealing with resentments. It's the story of a woman who knew she would drink over her mother. She'd been sober for, I think, 20 years. And she knew that if she didn't get rid of this resentment against her mother, she would drink. She didn't know what to do. And she comes across a magazine article. No one's been able to tell me what that article is. I've looked there. All these AA historians, but no one has yet been able to isolate that article. But it's an article written by a clergyman who says, if you have a resentment you can't get rid of, if you are so angry at a person you can't get rid of, then do this. Pray for that person to have everything you want out of life to happen to that person. Pray for that person, whether you mean it or not, for 2 weeks, day after day, and at the end of 2 weeks, you will have overcome your resentment. I had 5 people in my life when I first started this program whom I couldn't be in the same room with, whom I hated, and whom I resented for their existence. I won't go into details as to who they were, but they were 5 people. One of them is a person who's dead now, who was a lawyer who had really wronged me, betrayed my trust, and harmed a client of mine, and done it in a really cavalier way without showing any concern or remorse for the effects of what he had done. And he was really loved by a bunch of other lawyers who didn't know this, and I couldn't talk about it. It was a private, a confidential matter, so it's nothing I could, nor did I want to gossip about it anyway. And I wanted to resist the revenge motive that I felt, you know, so I didn't want to talk about it. But I couldn't be in the, I had a case against him and I couldn't deal with him. I couldn't be in the same room with him. And at the same time, there was a case going on. And I was completely screwing up the case because I was in this case and I was thinking about, I just want to get that guy. You know, I wasn't thinking about the case, I was thinking about dealing with him. So I took page 552 Okay, pray for him to have everything I want out of life. Well, what do I want out of life? What do I really want out of life? I want to be serene. I want to be able to love. I don't want to be able to be loved. I want to be useful. I mean, when you come down to it, what else do we want in our lives but something as basic as that? So I said, okay, I'm going to pray for X to have to be able to love and to be loved, to be serene, and to be useful in life. And I suddenly was hit in the head. This guy had none of that. He was on to his fourth marriage. Children from the first two wouldn't talk to him because of how he had treated the first two, his first two wives. He was a superficial guy who was liked only by people who didn't really know him. He was a drunk. He was taking all kinds of medication. Actually, he died at the age of 54 or something like that. He was killing himself with all of the addictions and the torments that he was living through. He had nothing I wanted out of life. And I immediately felt sorry for him. Sure, he had done something awful. But when he did something awful to me, he was doing something even worse to himself. He was losing part of his soul, if you will. Or, you know what I mean. I don't want to speak in any spiritual terms, but losing part of his humanity. Anyway. And I did the same with Hitler, who had no serenity, for whom there was no one he could trust, nothing he could love, a completely unlovable man. Oh, sure, people thought of him as incredible, but he knew the truth. I mean, you know, he was looked up to as a god, but either he was either fooling himself, and in his later years, I think he knew he was fooling others. He did awful things. I don't forgive those things. But as a man, I feel sorry for him. I can tell you, and I don't speak from personal experience here, that the people I know in this program, if we use this method to deal with the horrible assaults and abuse that they have suffered in their lives, have all been able to use this to tremendous effect. They are no longer in thrall. They are no longer in captivity to the people who did those things to them. And because of that, they have found this method just absolutely incredible. So this is the way to overcome it, and it's been amazing. As you see, though, one important aspect of this is that the more they do harm to you or they do harm to others, the more they do harm to themselves. Now, this is going to become very important when it comes to amends, because if you have done something to me and I continue to allow that thing to be done to me, I am doing not just myself harm, I'm doing you harm because you are continuing to do harm to yourself. And sometimes the greatest amend you can give to someone is to stop that person from doing harm to you. Yeah, you notice it's not an amend to yourself, it's an amend to the person. Stop it. You know, in a very simple analogous situation, if I had a relationship with a person that was exploitative and was hurtful to me, emotionally abusive to me, and I, it's only an analogy, it certainly isn't anything like what's happened to people I know in this program. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm equating that. I'm just giving an example. For me to say, stop, this is wrong, don't do this anymore, this relationship has to end, is the kindest thing I can do to that person, as well as, of course, to myself, but the kindest thing I can do to that person is that person is no longer able to do that. Okay. The Big Book goes through all of this for one reason only at the moment, and that is to isolate our problems, to isolate where we've been at fault. Because we can't figure out where we've been at fault until we've dealt with them. And by the way, because this is on a tape, I don't want to recommend non-OA literature, but if anyone wants to know about a particular book that really deals with this, I'd be happy to talk to them at another time, give you the name of it. But it's not OA literature, so I don't want to recommend it on tape. So the Big Book goes on. It says, referring on page 67, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Now, on this form, you will see some dotted lines. And the Big Book says, putting out of our minds the wrongs that others had done, if you fold the paper on these dotted lines, you will end up with column 1 right across from column 4. So you got the two dotted lines, you fold there, and you will find that column 1 and column 4, you will cross out, you will hide columns 1 and 4. There are two ways of doing it. You'll figure it out. You can fold the paper at any rate so that column 1 and column 4 are right next to each other, because you want to put out of your minds the wrongs that others have done. And now you've got the name, and you've got the question, where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Now, what does selfish mean? Well, we found the definition of selfish in the discussion at the beginning of the chapter, How It Works. The definition of selfish is wanting my way, period. For whatever reasons, wanting my way. So if I put down Hitler, where am I selfish in relation to Hitler? Wanting Hitler not to have existed. I want my way. Now, my motives are absolutely pure there. I lost no one in the Holocaust. My family lost no one in the Holocaust. We had come over, my grandparents came over in the early 1900s. So we lost no one. So there's no dictionary definition of selfish there. But there sure is the big book definition of selfish there. I want the past not to have occurred. I mean, it's just that simple. I want the Holocaust not to have occurred. Now, when it comes down to an ex-girlfriend I may have had, my selfishness may be a combination. I wanted to show her how love could overcome her problems. I suppose that might be virtuous in some way. I wanted to show her how I could help her overcome her problems through love. Well, a little bit more mixed motives there. And I wanted to exhibit her to other people to show that I could be attractive to beautiful people. Completely dictionary definition there. So those are three different selfishnesses in there where I want my way. So you can see that it's a whole mixture of reasons why. When my daughter was on the list when she was going through these difficult times, you know, I would come up selfishness. You know, I want her to do well. I want her to be different from who she was. And so many of my friends who grew up with difficult parents, one or both, would write down, I wanted my parents to be someone else's parents. You know, I wanted someone else's parents to have been my parents. That's probably a better definition. And I wanted something different. So selfishness can be a whole gamut of things, and you'll discover different things as you go. Here you're doing some thinking. This is the only part where you're really doing some thinking. What does dishonest mean? Well, there are three kinds of dishonesty, it seems to me, at least. One kind of dishonesty is the kind we normally think of. You've stolen, you've lied, you've cheated, you know, the fraud, the falseness, the active bits of dishonesty that we often do in our lives, that we've done in our lives. The second kind of dishonesty is lying to ourselves. When I put down, I want Hitler not to have existed, under dishonesty, I wrote down, he died before you were born. I mean, you have no power over that. What kind of a stupid wish is that? You're lying to yourself that somehow the world can change. The world that's already existed, that happened before you were born, should not have existed. There's a dishonesty there. Or a dishonesty in relation to girlfriends. You're living a lie. People will either be attracted to you or not because of yourself, not because of whom you got in your arm. Right? So there is this dishonesty of lying to yourself. As if love could solve everything. It didn't. I remember writing down about one of my girlfriends, you said to yourself, because I do remember saying this, she can give me all she's got and I'll show that love can triumph. And then she gave me all she had. Well, why am I mad at her for giving me all she had? I invited her to give me all she had. Believe me, love didn't triumph. But you know what I'm saying? Like that's a dishonesty to myself. And then there's a third dishonesty that I think is extremely important for OAers who are people pleasers, of which, as I said, many of us are. And that is that we don't tell the truth when the truth should be told. That we lie back and don't tell the truth. And it can be as simple as not saying something that should be said when people are gossiping about someone. Or it might be as serious as saying, stop this action. This is wrong. I won't accept this. I'm out of this relationship. I mean, something as deep as that. Or it might be, as one of my friends discovered, I haven't told the family about the sexual abuse I suffered when I was a kid by this uncle who's still at this party and still being treated nicely by other people. And so other children might have suffered what I suffered. I mean, that's a dishonesty that my friend came to the conclusion that she had committed for a very long time. So dishonesty can sometimes be something very, very deep, and not just sort of being fraudulent to other people, but can be lying to yourself or not telling the truth to others. And I think that's a really, really important point. I'll finish the definitions of self-seeking and frightened, and then it'll be a good time to break. What is self-seeking? That's the hardest question I've ever had to answer in my study of the Big Book, because there isn't an easy answer. The best I can come up with is that self-seeking, at the very least, is looking for other people to define you and how you feel about yourself. Sort of self-seeking, seeking myself or my sense of self in other people, how they affect your self-esteem, how they affect how you feel about yourself. The other aspect of self-seeking is it's all about me. It's all sort of how it affects me and not other people. This person may have done something to 20 people, but I only care about what happened to me. It's sort of that aspect of it. And it's also not thinking of other people, but thinking of yourself. And that's the best I can come up with. It's all those things in one. It's just sort of looking to yourself as the center of the universe. And we really are. I mean, most of us are the heroes of our own movie, and everyone else is a bit player. And that's what self-seeking is. And then frightened is fear. It's just full of fear. And sometimes the fear is being found out. And sometimes the fear is not getting what you want or losing what you have. But there are all kinds of fears relating to it. I put down a guy I used to gossip about. I told true stories about him that held him up to ridicule. And as I went through how that affected me, I didn't like him either. He didn't like me. And so I would tell these stories, and they were true, absolutely true. I was pretty accurate. But he was not a well man. Actually, quite a sick person. And as I went through this, my selfishness was, I wanted people to like me and dislike him. And my dishonesty was, he's a sick man, and I'm making fun of a sickness. Because what was funny, supposedly funny about him, was in fact the symptoms of his sickness. I was self-seeking in that I was more concerned about my reputation than his. And I was frightened that he'd find out about it. So gossiping became far deeper for me than just gossiping as a character defect. Gossiping was an aspect of my selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, and fear. My lousy relationships, my jealousy, my conceit, my whatever all those seven deadly sins are, and whatever all the other 25 or 30 or 40 or 50 numbered lists of defects of characters are, they all come down to wanting life to be different, being dishonest with someone, looking to myself and not to others, and being full of fear. And as I worked through this form, I began to see how deep all this was in me, but I also began to see something else. There are only four of them. Four defects of character. Okay, if I get rid of these four. It was pointed out to me, I was holding up three fingers. Four. I wonder what happened to my other finger. I thought I had six fingers. Anyway, if I could get rid of these four defects of character, I'd be free. And that's the beauty of this, because by the time we get to six and seven, and we only have four defects of character to get rid of, we're ready to get rid of them, you know? So this is, for me, it's tremendously brilliant. And we'll stop there. And we'll take a break. We'll take I'd say a 15-minute break, and come back about 2:55. Okay? Thank you.